My name is Adept Thaddeus Crowell, Tertiary Data Curator of the Administratum Branch on Vestigium. 3 standard months ago, I was concerned with nothing more than the proper cataloging of agricultural tithe records and ensuring the correct decimal placement in harvest projections. Now I spend my waking hours listening for the telltale roar of greenskins and calculating how many more days we might survive. The orcs came without warning, as they often do. Vestigium was an unremarkable agri-world, thousands of square kilometers of golden grain fields feeding countless imperial worlds in this sector. Our planetary defense force consisted of farmer soldiers who trained 1 weekend per month. They were slaughtered within days. The 3 regiments of Astra Militarum stationed on our world fared little better against what we later learned was a splinter of Warboss Grimskull's Wa. I was conducting a routine inspection at Data Vault Tertius Epsilon when the orbital communications array went silent. Located 20 kilometers from the capital, our facility housed agricultural production records dating back 17 generations, irreplaceable data that determined tithe grades and production quotas for dozens of subsectors. The Administratum values such information above human lives. In this rare instance, I cannot disagree with their calculus. Without these records, billions might starve across thousands of worlds. The vault was not built for defense. A 3-story rockcrete structure with reinforced data stacks, it had 1 armored entrance and minimal security features. When the first refugees arrived, bloodied PDF troopers dragging wounded comrades, I realized the magnitude of our situation. The capital had fallen, Governor Thelian was dead. The greenskins were systematically destroying everything in their path. By nightfall, our population had swelled to 378 souls. Most were Administratum workers like myself, soft-bodied and untrained. 63 were PDF troopers, shell-shocked and demoralized. The remaining 22 were Astra Militarum veterans, mostly logistics and support personnel who had been rotating out when the attack began. Among them was Quartermaster Dravik of the Death Corps of Krieg. Even now, I remember my first impression of Dravik. Tall and gaunt, with eyes that seemed to have witnessed horrors beyond imagination. Unlike most Krieg officers, he wore no mask. His face was a roadmap of scar tissue, burns covering most of his left side. He took command without speaking a word. The PDF captain simply stepped aside, recognizing authority when he saw it. Dravik's assessment of our situation was methodical and merciless. Our ammunition reserves would last approximately 2 weeks under siege conditions. Our food stores could sustain us for perhaps a month with strict rationing. The nearest Imperial response force was 3 months away at best, assuming our emergency astropathic message had even reached them. Most damning was our defensive position. The data vault had never been intended as a fortress. Its walls were thick but not impenetrable to determined orc artillery. For 3 days, we prepared as best we could. Administratum workers were assigned to support roles, tending the wounded, preparing rations, maintaining the generators that kept the data stacks powered and climate controlled. Those with any weapons training were given las guns and positioned at key points. I found myself designated as Dravik's adjutant, likely because I knew the facility better than anyone. The first orc assault came at dawn on the 4th day. 500 greenskins charging across the open fields, their crude weapons raised high. We repelled them, but at terrible cost. 73 dead, 41 wounded too severely to fight again. The next attack came 2 days later, smaller but more focused. The greenskins had brought crude artillery, targeting our eastern wall. By the end of the 2nd week, our numbers had dwindled to 241. The eastern wall had partially collapsed, hastily reinforced with furniture and machinery. Our ammunition stores were nearly depleted, and the wounded lay in rows throughout the lower-level data stacks. The smell of gangrene and death permeated everything. I found Dravik in what had become our command center, formerly my office, studying hand-drawn maps of our perimeter. His expression remained unchanged when I delivered the latest casualty reports. He simply nodded, made a notation, and continued his calculations. Then he looked up at me with those hollow eyes and explained his solution. The dead would serve us once more. At first, I thought exhaustion had affected his mind. He elaborated with the cold efficiency I had come to expect from him. Our perimeter required reinforcement. We lacked materials, but we had corpses, 137 and counting. Bones could be harvested, processed, and repurposed. Skulls could replace sandbags. Ribcages could be fashioned into defensive barriers. Femurs could reinforce weakened structures. My revulsion must have shown on my face. Dravik reminded me that the Emperor's servants give everything in his service. Their souls had already joined him. Their mortal remains were simply resources now. Practical, efficient, necessary. I wanted to object, to cite some obscure regulation against desecration of Imperial dead, but the alternative was death for us all, and the loss of the data we were sworn to protect. The calculus was simple, if horrific. The dead would serve, or the living would join them. Dravik assembled a team of 10 former Medicae assistants, butchers, anyone with experience in anatomy. They began with the oldest corpses, those already beginning to decompose in the makeshift morgue we had established in the lower levels. I could not watch, but I could hear the wet sounds of flesh being separated from bone, the crack and snap of joints being disarticulated, the rhythmic scraping of knives against calcium deposits. By nightfall, the first macabre fortifications were in place. Skulls, cleaned and stacked, formed crude but effective barriers at vulnerable points along our perimeter. Ribcages, interlocked and secured with wire, created fencing that channeled potential attackers into kill zones. Longer bones reinforced weakened sections of wall. The effect on morale was complex. Some were horrified, refusing to go near the bone fortifications. Others found grim humor in it, painting crude Imperial aquilas on skulls or naming sections of the defenses after fallen comrades. Most, like me, simply accepted it as necessity, another horror in a galaxy full of them. 3 days later, the orcs attacked again. Their charge faltered when they encountered our new defenses. Perhaps even their primitive minds recognized something unnatural in our fortifications. This hesitation gave our defenders precious seconds to target the largest greenskins, disrupting their momentum. For the first time, we repelled them with minimal casualties, just 7 dead and 12 wounded. Dravik took this as validation. The bone fortifications were expanded, becoming more elaborate. He developed a process for reinforcing the bones with resin from our data preservation supplies, making them more durable. The dead from the latest attack were processed within hours of confirmation of death, their service to the Emperor continuing without interruption. I found myself becoming numb to it. My initial horror faded, replaced by a detached fascination with the efficiency of it all. I began suggesting improvements, ways to interlock femurs for greater structural integrity, methods for securing pelvic bones to create stable platforms for our few remaining heavy weapons. Dravik approved my suggestions with the barest nod, incorporating them into his designs. By the end of the first month, our perimeter was a grotesque monument to Imperial pragmatism. 3 layers of defenses, all crafted from human remains. The outer layer consisted of sharpened bone spikes and rib fencing, designed to slow and channel attackers. The second layer was a wall of compacted skulls and larger bones, reinforced with resin and metal salvaged from destroyed equipment. The inner layer was our original structure, now buttressed at weak points with bone columns and braces. The orcs continued their sporadic attacks, but with diminishing success. Their losses mounted while ours decreased. We began a hope that we might survive until reinforcements arrived. The data vault, our primary mission, remained secure, its precious contents intact. Then came the silence. For 6 days, no orc attacks. Our scouts reported movement in their camps, but no aggression. On the 7th day, we observed massive columns of greenskins moving away from our position, toward the south. Intercepted Vox chatter suggested a larger Imperial force had landed on the southern continent. The WA was redirecting to meet this new threat. We should have felt relief. Instead, an unsettling quiet descended upon us. Without the immediate threat of attack, we turned our attention inward. The bone fortifications stood as silent testimony to what we had done, to what we had become, yet Dravik did not order a halt to the processing. The dead from disease and previous wounds continued to be harvested, their remains added to our defenses. When I questioned this, Dravik simply gestured to the horizon. The orcs might return, other threats might emerge. Our duty was to protect the data vault until properly relieved, and every resource must be utilized toward that end. The Emperor's calculus was absolute, efficiency above all. I returned to my duties, cataloging our remaining supplies and maintaining the environmental systems for the data stacks. But each night I found myself walking the perimeter, touching the smooth surfaces of skulls that had once contained the thoughts of men and women I had known. I began to notice details I had overlooked in our desperate struggle for survival. the fortifications were becoming more elaborate than necessary. Patterns had emerged in the arrangement of bones, symmetries and structures that served no obvious defensive purpose. Dravik spent hours each day inspecting and adjusting the bone constructions, moving individual skulls mere centimeters, aligning femurs to precise angles. His team worked with increasing precision, following his exacting specifications without question. I observed them sorting bones not just by type but by subtle variations in size and shape, creating gradients of human remains that formed flowing lines throughout our defenses. What had begun as desperate necessity was evolving into something else, something methodical and purposeful beyond mere survival. The Emperor's calculus, as Dravik called it, was becoming more complex, its variables and functions obscure to all but him. And still we built. Even as the immediate threat receded, even as our numbers stabilized at 183 survivors, the construction continued. The dead served, as Dravik had promised. But to what end, I was beginning to wonder, and when would their service, our service, be complete? The first skull I processed myself belonged to Adept Marin, a man I had worked alongside for 7 years. His data retention scores had always been exemplary. Now his cranium would serve a different purpose. I held his skull in my hands, the weight of it surprising me. The Medicae assistants had already cleaned it thoroughly. No trace remained of the man who had once quoted regulatory statutes from memory. I followed Dravik's precise instructions. The lower jaw was removed and cataloged separately. Mandibles had proven useful as binding components when lashed together. The cranium was inspected for fractures or structural weaknesses. Finding none, I used a hand drill to create drainage holes at the base. Then came the filling, a mixture of crushed rockcrete, adhesive resin, and a binding agent derived from rendered human fat. The substance poured easily into the skull cavity, hardening within hours to create a solid mass that retained the skull's shape while multiplying its strength tenfold. Marin became one of 57 skull bricks I processed that day. Each was tagged with a small parchment notation indicating its position in the eastern reinforcement wall. Dravik's system demanded absolute precision. Skulls of similar dimensions were grouped together to ensure structural integrity. The uniformity created an unsettling symmetry when viewed from a distance. Our methodology evolved rapidly. Ribcages required the most elaborate preparation. After cleaning, each was carefully disarticulated, the sternum separated from the ribs with surgical precision. The curved bones were then sorted by size and flexibility. The most robust were reinforced with wire salvaged from damaged Vox units, creating a framework that could be interwoven with barbed wire from our dwindling perimeter defenses. The resulting structures resembled macabre fencing, organic yet mechanical, yielding yet unyielding. When installed at our vulnerable northern approach, they channeled attacking greenskins into prepared kill zones with remarkable efficiency. Femurs proved the most versatile. Their dense composition made them ideal for structural support. The longest and straightest were lashed together with strips of dried sinew to form the framework of our watchtowers. Four such towers now stood at cardinal points around our perimeter, each capable of supporting the weight of two observers and a heavy stubber. The construction required precise mathematical calculations, the distribution of weight, the angle of support struts, the tension of binding materials. I found myself drawing on data organization principles from my administratum training, creating a system of bone classification that maximized structural utility. The most disturbing element was the harvesting of skin. This task fell to former textile workers among our survivors who had experience with stretching and treating materials. Human skin, properly cured with chemicals from our data preservation supplies, created effective camouflage netting when stretched across frames constructed from smaller bones. The coloration, mottled browns and grays, blended naturally with the scorched landscape surrounding our position. From 50 meters, our fortifications became nearly invisible until one was almost upon them. My initial revulsion faded with each passing day. The human mind adapts to horror with disturbing ease. What had once seemed sacrilege became routine. I developed a ledger system for tracking our materials, categorizing each body part by its utility. Type A bones for structural support, type B for binding and reinforcement, type C for specialized applications. Soft tissues had their own classification system, though most were rendered for their chemical components rather than used directly. efficiency became my obsession. I calculated the average yield from each corpse. Approximately 60% of material could be repurposed for our defenses. The remainder was either too damaged or structurally unsuitable. Nothing was wasted. Even pulverized bone fragments were mixed with adhesive to create a form of mortar that filled gaps between larger components. The practical results were undeniable. When the orcs mounted their fourth major assault, they broke against our defenses like waves against a cliff. Their crude explosives detonated against skull walls that absorbed and dispersed the force. Their charging bodies became entangled in rib fencing, easy targets for our conserved ammunition. For the first time, we suffered no casualties during an attack. This success transformed something within us. I observed the psychological shift among my fellow survivors with the same analytical detachment I applied to our fortifications. Initial disgust gave way to reluctant acceptance, then to a disturbing sense of purpose. Survivors who had retched at the sight of processing teams now volunteered for harvesting duty. Some began referring to specific sections of our defenses by the names of those whose remains comprised them. Delian's Watch for the northeastern tower, Marius Wall for the reinforced southern approach. The language we used changed subtly, then dramatically. We no longer spoke of corpses, but of raw materials or resources. The processing area became the conversion chapel. Those who worked there called themselves renders rather than butchers or medike. A specialized lexicon emerged, divorced from the humanity of what we were doing. We spoke of bone mortar and sinew lashing and skull bricks with the detached precision of manufactorum workers. Rituals developed organically among the renders. They began each processing session with whispered prayers to the Emperor, asking his blessing on their grim work. Each skull was marked with a tiny aquila before filling, visible only to those who knew to look for it. Many renders developed the habit of thanking the dead as they worked, murmuring phrases like, "Your service continues," or "The Emperor remembers your sacrifice," while extracting useful components. I documented these behaviors in my personal data slate, analyzing them as I would any other pattern. The ritualization served a psychological purpose, I concluded. It created distance between the renders and the horror of their actions, while simultaneously justifying those actions within the framework of imperial faith. The Emperor demanded sacrifice. We were merely extending that sacrifice beyond death. My own role evolved beyond mere record keeping. I began conducting efficiency analyses, determining which body parts provided the greatest defensive value per unit of effort expended. Skulls ranked highest. Their natural structure required minimal modification to serve as building materials. Femurs followed close behind. Smaller bones like fingers and ribs required more processing time relative to their structural contribution, but their flexibility made them invaluable for specific applications. The fifth orc assault came 3 weeks after our renovations began. By then, our perimeter had expanded by 30 meters in all directions. Three layers of defenses protected our data vault. The outermost consisted of concealed pits lined with sharpened bone spikes, covered with camouflage netting made from cured skin. Beyond these, fields of rib fencing created a labyrinth that funneled attackers into predetermined kill zones. The innermost layer was our masterpiece, a continuous wall of skull bricks 3 meters high, reinforced with femur buttresses at regular intervals. The greenskins never breached the second layer. Their losses were catastrophic, over 200 dead by our estimates. Our casualties numbered 3 wounded, none seriously. The efficiency was undeniable. The Emperor's calculus, as Dravik called it, had proven correct. That night I found Dravik at the eastern wall, his gaunt fingers tracing patterns across the surface of skull bricks. His expression remained impassive, but I detected something new in his posture, not satisfaction exactly, but a form of validation. He had made notations on a hand-drawn map, marking points where our defenses could be further extended. Another 30 meters outward, another layer of protection. The plans required materials we did not yet possess, but Dravik's calculations included projections of future casualties, both enemy and our own. I should have been disturbed by this cold arithmetic of death. Instead, I found myself suggesting improvements to his design. The southeastern approach could be reinforced with a specialized arrangement of interlocking pelvic bones. The western wall could incorporate a series of observation niches constructed from vertebral columns. Dravik incorporated my suggestions without comment, his pencil making precise adjustments to his schematics. The renders worked through the night, processing the greenskin corpses that lay scattered across our killing fields. Orc remains proved less useful than human. Their bones were denser but more brittle, their proportions less suited to our architectural needs. Still, their skulls could be filled with rockcrete like any others, and their larger bones served adequately for non-critical structures. We would not waste potential materials, regardless of origin. By the 47th day of our siege, our fortifications had taken on an architectural complexity that belied their grim composition. Bone buttresses supported walls of graduated skull bricks, their surfaces polished by constant handling. Watchtowers rose from our perimeter, their frames constructed from femurs lashed together with sinew and wire, their platforms supported by pelvic cradles. Rib fencing created elaborate defensive patterns across our approaches, channeling any attacker into killing grounds covered by our remaining heavy weapons. The orc attacks diminished in frequency and intensity. Whether they had been called to fight elsewhere or had developed a superstitious fear of our position, I could not determine. Our scouts reported reduced activity in their distant camps. The immediate threat appeared to be receding. Logic dictated that we should conserve our resources, focusing on maintenance rather than expansion. Yet the construction continued. Renders processed the few new casualties with increasing precision, extracting maximum utility from each corpse. Engineering teams developed new techniques for binding and reinforcing bone structures. Expansion plans were drawn up, then implemented, then expanded again. I found myself spending hours each day inspecting and cataloging our growing fortifications. My data slate contained detailed records of each section, its composition, structural integrity, defensive value. I developed a maintenance schedule, assigning teams to reinforce aging sections before they could deteriorate. The work absorbed me completely, crowding out memories of my former life as a data curator. The renders now spoke of their work as a form of veneration. They no longer simply thanked the dead, they addressed them as continuing participants in our defense. Phrases like the Emperor's Eternal Guard and the Unending Watch entered common usage. Some began decorating skull bricks with miniature devotional symbols, tiny aquilas etched into bone, prayer scripts written in microscopic text across cranial surfaces. When our astropathic message finally received response on the 53rd day, the news should have brought relief. Imperial forces had indeed landed on the southern continent. The Orc Wa had been engaged and was being systematically destroyed. Relief forces would reach our position within 2 weeks. Our mission to protect the data vault would soon be complete. The announcement was met with an unsettling silence. Survivors exchanged glances but said nothing. That night, construction activity increased. Renders worked double shifts, processing our remaining materials with feverish intensity. Engineering teams began work on a new expansion, a ceremonial arch constructed from vertebrae and ribs that would mark the main approach to our position. I found myself unable to sleep, walking our perimeter in the darkness. The bone construction seemed to whisper in the night wind, a susurration of calcified tissue that had once contained human life. My hand traced the smooth surface of a skull brick, feeling the microscopic imperfections that identified it as having once belonged to Adept Urus, a man who had spent 30 years calculating agricultural production quotas. Our creation had transcended its original purpose. What had begun as desperate necessity had evolved into something approaching devotion. The dead protected us not merely through the repurposing of their physical remains, but through a transformation of our understanding of service. The Emperor's servants gave everything, not just their lives, but their very substance. Their service continued beyond death, beyond the separation of soul from body. Dravik's calculations had proven correct in ways I had not anticipated. The efficiency of our defenses was measurable in casualty figures and repelled attacks. But the psychological transformation of the survivors was equally significant. We had embraced a new understanding of imperial service, one that recognized no distinction between living duty and dead utility. As dawn broke on the 54th day, I stood atop our highest watchtower, surveying what we had created. Our fortifications now extended nearly 100 meters from the original data vault in all directions. The bone constructions had taken on an architectural coherence that suggested purpose beyond mere defense. Patterns emerged when viewed from above, concentric circles, radiating lines, geometric forms that echoed ancient devotional structures. The Emperor's calculus was elegant in its simplicity. All served in their capacity. All continued to serve according to their utility. The distinction between life and death was merely operational, not fundamental. I made a notation in my data slate, calculating the defensive value of the newest additions to our perimeter. The numbers were satisfactory. Efficiency remained high. I estimated that our current construction rate could be maintained indefinitely, given a steady supply of materials. In the distance, I could see dust clouds approaching from the south. Imperial relief forces, perhaps. They would find our data vault secure, its precious contents preserved. They would find 179 survivors dedicated to their continued service. They would find our creation, a fortress of bone and sinew, constructed according to the Emperor's calculus, and they would understand, as we now understood, that service to the Imperium transcended the simple binary of life and death. 3 months into our defense of Data Vault Tertius Epsilon, our bone fortifications had evolved beyond mere necessity into something approaching architectural artistry. The outer walls now extended nearly 200 meters from the original structure, creating a series of concentric defenses that had proven impenetrable to the increasingly sporadic orc attacks. The greenskins seemed to have developed a primitive superstition about our position, avoiding direct assaults in favor of probing actions that were easily repelled. I maintained meticulous records of our defensive efficiency in my data slate. The numbers told a compelling story. Our casualty rate had decreased by 87% since implementing Dravik's ossuary construction methods. In the last month, we had lost only 4 defenders to enemy action, compared to dozens in the early days of the siege. By any rational metric, our adaptation had been successful. Yet success had changed us in ways I found increasingly difficult to catalog with my usual analytical detachment. The first indication came during the morning inspection rounds. I was documenting structural integrity in the eastern quadrant when I noticed Quartermaster Dravik examining a wounded defender. The man, Corporal Hessen, formerly of the PDF, had suffered a compound fracture of his left arm during a night patrol. Under normal circumstances, such an injury would have meant reassignment to non-combat duties until healing was complete. Dravik circled the injured man with methodical precision, his gaunt features betraying no emotion as he assessed the wound. He made notations in a small leather-bound book I had never seen before. Then he asked a series of questions that I could not hear from my position. Hessen's face paled as the conversation progressed. When Dravik finally departed, the corporal remained frozen in place, staring at his injured arm with an expression of profound dread. Later that day, I discovered what had transpired. Dravik had implemented what he termed optimization protocols for the garrison. Each defender was now evaluated not merely on their combat effectiveness, but on their potential contribution to our defenses in either capacity, as fighters or as construction materials. The calculation was brutally simple. If an individual's projected defensive value as processed material exceeded their combat utility, they would be reassigned to the conversion chapel. Hessen had been deemed more valuable as a combatant than as material, at least for now. His relief was palpable when I encountered him later, his arms splinted and bound. Others had not received such favorable assessments. 3 defenders with chronic injuries disappeared from the duty roster that week. Their names appeared in my materials ledger 2 days later, their remains categorized and processed according to our established protocols. I should have been horrified. Instead, I found myself analyzing the efficiency of Dravik's calculations. The logic was undeniable. A defender who could no longer fight effectively represented an ongoing resource drain. Converting such individuals to construction materials maximized their service to the Emperor. I added a new section to my ledger, tracking the defensive value added by these optimized personnel. The protocols expanded over subsequent weeks. Dravik developed a complex scoring system that assigned numerical values to each defender based on combat effectiveness, specialized skills, and physical characteristics. Those who fell below a certain threshold were given opportunities to improve their scores through additional training or by volunteering for high-risk duties. Those who failed to improve were processed. Fear became a powerful motivator. Defenders push themselves beyond normal human limits, ignoring injuries and exhaustion to maintain acceptable scores. Some began sabotaging others, ensuring their relative value remained high enough to avoid reassignment. The garrison fractured into informal hierarchies based on Dravik's metrics, with the highest scored individuals enjoying privileges, while the lowest lived in constant dread of the conversion chapel. I rationalized my participation in this system as necessary for our survival. The data vault remained our primary mission, and anything that enhanced its protection served the Emperor's will. When I conducted inspections alongside Dravik, I found myself evaluating my fellow survivors with the same cold calculation, noting which ones might soon provide more value as materials than as combatants. By the 90th day of our siege, a new doctrine had emerged among the garrison. Dravik never formally articulated it, but it spread through our ranks nonetheless. We called it the ossification doctrine, the belief that the strongest defense came from the literal transformation of the living into the dead, the flesh into bone, the temporary into the permanent. Service to the Emperor meant accepting one's inevitable conversion from defender to defense. The practical results were undeniable. Our fortifications grew more elaborate and effective with each passing week. The outer perimeter now featured interlocking fields of fire, fallback positions, and even primitive artillery emplacements constructed from the largest orc bones. The main approaches were channeled through killing grounds, where even a small number of defenders could repel a significant assault. Our scouts reported that the orc presence in our sector had diminished significantly. The Wa had been drawn south to engage the Imperial Relief Force, leaving only scattered warbands to maintain pressure on our position. These sporadic attacks were easily repelled, often with no casualties on our side. The immediate threat had receded, yet our construction continued unabated. On the 92nd day, everything changed. The distant rumble of aircraft engines drew us to our observation posts. Three Valkyrie transports approached from the south, their Imperial markings clearly visible as they circled our position. After 3 months of isolation, contact with the broader Imperium had been re-established. The Valkyries landed in a cleared area beyond our outermost defenses. From the lead craft emerged a squad of soldiers unlike any I had seen before, massive, heavily muscled men with skin the color of scorched earth. They moved with predatory grace through our bone fence perimeter, their eyes constantly scanning for threats. Catachan jungle fighters, I realized, among the deadliest light infantry in the Imperial Guard. Their captain approached our main gate, a massive arch constructed from the femurs of particularly large orcs, topped with a row of human skulls arranged in the pattern of an Imperial aquila. He stopped abruptly, his weathered face registering the first genuine shock I had seen from a Catachan. His gaze traveled upward, taking in the full macabre splendor of our creation. Dravik met them at the gate, his gaunt form a stark contrast to the massive Catachans. No words were exchanged at first, just a long, evaluative silence as the jungle fighters processed what they were seeing. I stood behind Dravik with my data slate, ready to provide any information required about our defenses. The Catachan captain's initial horror was evident in his posture and expression. His men fingered their weapons nervously, their eyes darting between the skull walls and the gaunt defenders who stood watch from bone towers. One made the sign of the aquila, his lips moving in what appeared to be a prayer for protection. Dravik provided a methodical briefing on our situation, explaining the necessity that had driven our construction methods. The Catachan captain's expression shifted gradually from disgust to grudging professional assessment. When Dravik described the defensive properties of our bone fortifications, their resistance to orc artillery, their psychological impact on attacking forces, their structural resilience, the Catachans began to examine our creation with newfound interest. By the time Dravik had completed his explanation, the jungle fighters were walking the perimeter, studying our construction techniques with the eyes of veterans who had seen countless battlefield fortifications. I heard one remark that the design was more effective than anything he'd seen outside of established Imperial strongpoints. Another noted the psychological impact such defenses would have on human enemies, though orcs were too simple to fully appreciate the horror of what they faced. Within hours, the Catachans had integrated themselves into our defensive positions. Their commander informed us that they represented the vanguard of a larger Imperial relief force. The Orc War had been engaged and broken in the Southern Hemisphere, but scattered warbands remained active across the planet. Our data vault was to be reinforced and held until the planet could be fully secured, a process that might take several more months. The jungle fighters brought supplies with them, ammunition, medical equipment, and ration packs. Most importantly, they brought conventional construction materials, rockcrete mix, prefabricated defensive barriers, and rolls of razor wire. These resources should have allowed us to supplement our bone fortifications with standard Imperial defenses. Dravik had other ideas. When the Katachan engineers began unloading their construction materials, he approached their sergeant with my efficiency analyses in hand. The numbers were irrefutable. Our bone fortifications had proven 23% more resistant to Orc artillery than standard rockcrete barriers of equivalent thickness. The psychological impact on attacking forces was even more significant, resulting in a 41% reduction in offensive coordination during assaults. The Katachans were professionals above all else. When presented with data demonstrating superior defensive performance, they set aside their initial revulsion. By the end of the first day, they were assisting our renders in processing the most recent Orc casualties, learning our techniques for bone preparation and structural reinforcement. Their expertise in field fortifications allowed them to suggest improvements to our designs, methods of interlocking femurs to create more stable support structures, techniques for treating bone to increase weather resistance. I observed this integration with satisfaction, updating my records to include the new construction methods. The Katachan's arrival had validated our approach rather than ending it. The Emperor's calculus remained sound. That night, I overheard a conversation that should have disturbed me more than it did. Two of our senior renders were discussing the structural properties of different human remains with a Katachan engineer. They had begun categorizing bone by source. PDF troopers provided adequate general material, but administratum workers often had denser cranial bones due to their sedentary lifestyles. The Katachan suggested that his own kind would provide superior structural components due to their enhanced musculature and bone density. This analysis extended to combat roles. Heavy weapons specialists developed stronger shoulder and arm bones from managing recoil. Scouts and light infantry had more flexible ribcage that could be processed into specialized defensive components. The conversation had moved beyond mere necessity into a disturbing taxonomy of human remains categorized by their utility in death. Most disturbing was the realization that we had begun harvesting Orc corpses not out of desperation, but because we had determined that human remains were superior building materials. The greenskins' bones were too brittle, their proportions unsuited to our architectural needs. We had developed a preference for human materials based purely on their structural properties. The renders spoke of inefficiencies in processing Xeno's remains as if the only consideration was the quality of the end product. Over the following week, Imperial supply convoys arrived regularly, bringing conventional construction materials and additional troops to secure our position. Standard defensive protocols would have dictated a transition away from our improvised methods toward Imperial military engineering standards. Yet the opposite occurred. Dravik convinced the Katachan commander that our methods represented an adaptation to local conditions that should be maintained and expanded. The ossuary construction continued unabated. New defensive layers extended outward from our original position, incorporating both conventional materials and processed remains in a hybrid architecture that combined Imperial military precision with our macabre innovation. The Katachans added their own refinements, traps and killing grounds inspired by the death jungles of their homeworld, constructed from human and Orc bones arranged in patterns designed to channel and destroy attacking forces. I maintained my ledgers with increasing precision, developing new categories for the various types of materials we now processed. My analytical approach earned respect from the Katachan engineers, who incorporated my efficiency metrics into their own construction plans. We developed a collaborative methodology that maximized the defensive value of each processed corpse. The war on Vestigium was winding down. Reports from across the planet indicated that the Orc forces had been reduced to isolated pockets of resistance that were being systematically eliminated. The data vault's strategic importance diminished as Imperial authorities re-established control over the planet's infrastructure. Under normal circumstances, our mission would have been deemed complete, yet Dravik insisted that our work continue. When Imperial supply officers attempted to redirect construction materials to other recovery efforts, he presented detailed analyses demonstrating the ongoing threat to our position. When medical officers questioned our optimization protocols for injured defenders, he provided documentation showing the increased defensive efficiency resulting from these measures. Each challenge to our methods was met with cold, numerical logic that few could refute. The ossification doctrine had taken root beyond our original garrison. I observed Catachon veterans instructing newly arrived Imperial troops in bone processing techniques. The language they used mirrored our own evolved terminology, speaking of resource conversion rather than death, of structural integration rather than desecration. The clinical detachment that had developed among our original defenders spread to these newcomers with disturbing ease. Most concerning was Dravik's response when Imperial authorities finally established a secure supply line that could provide conventional building materials in abundance. Rather than transitioning to standard construction methods, he intensified our harvesting operations. The justification shifted from necessity to efficiency. Bone fortifications were not merely adequate substitutes for conventional defenses, but superior in specific applications. The Emperor's calculus now dictated that we continue our methods not because we had no alternative, but because we had found a better way. I found myself agreeing with this assessment. My data showed clearly that certain defensive structures performed better when constructed from processed remains than from conventional materials. The psychological impact on attacking forces remained significant even against disciplined opponents. The resource efficiency was undeniable. The dead provided materials without logistical cost beyond processing. 3 months after the orc attack that had initiated our desperate innovation, we had created something unprecedented, a hybrid fortress of conventional Imperial construction reinforced and enhanced by the processed remains of the dead. The data vault remained secure, its precious contents preserved. Our casualties had decreased to nearly zero. By every measurable metric, we had succeeded in our mission. Yet as I updated my ledgers that night, calculating the defensive value of our latest constructions, I found myself troubled by a question I could not quantify. At what point had our methods become an end unto themselves rather than a means of survival? The Emperor's calculus remained sound, but the variables had changed in ways I had not anticipated. The dead continued to serve. The living continued to build. And I continued to record it all with the detached precision of a true servant of the Administratum, even as I wondered what we were becoming. 6 months after our first desperate measures, I no longer recognized what we had become. The bone fortifications had grown beyond all reasonable military necessity, sprawling across the blasted landscape like the skeleton of some vast, impossible creature. What began as survival had transformed into something far more disturbing, a new ideology born from desperation and nurtured by Dravik's cold calculations. The orc threat had been eliminated 3 months prior. The scattered warbands that once prowled the perimeter of our compound had been systematically hunted down by Catachon patrols. The last confirmed greenskin sighting occurred 78 days ago, according to my meticulous records. By any rational assessment, our defensive posture should have relaxed. The emergency that justified our grim methods had passed, yet our construction accelerated. I stood on the observation platform of what we now called the vertebral spire, a twisting tower of interlocked spinal columns rising 20 meters above the original data vault. From this vantage point, I could survey the full extent of our creation. The original administrative complex was barely visible beneath layers of ossuary architecture. Concentric rings of defenses extended outward, each more elaborate than the last. What had begun as simple barriers had evolved into a complex of structures that served purposes far beyond mere protection. To the east stood the new Administratum complex, constructed entirely from processed human remains. The building's facade featured graduated rows of skulls, arranged by size and shape to create an unsettling symmetry. Supporting columns consisted of femurs bound together with wire and resin, creating load-bearing structures of surprising strength. The interior walls were lined with flattened ribcages, their curved surfaces providing both structural support and acoustic dampening for the data scribes who had resumed their work within. The western quadrant housed our living quarters, if they could still be called that. The barracks had been expanded and rebuilt using our established techniques. Sleeping platforms were supported by frameworks of tibia and fibula bones, arranged in lattice patterns that distributed weight efficiently. Privacy screens consisted of stretched and treated human skin, cured to the consistency of parchment and painted with administrative sigils. The communal areas featured benches constructed from pelvic bones, their natural curvature providing ergonomic seating that my efficiency analysis had rated 22% more comfortable than standard imperial designs. Most disturbing was the chapel that dominated the southern approach. What had begun as a simple shrine to the emperor had grown into a grotesque cathedral of human remains. Buttresses of femurs supported arches of precisely arranged vertebrae. The altar was a massive construction of interlocked pelvic bones, topped with a surface of polished skull caps. Above it hung a massive aquila fashioned from shoulder blades and finger bones, meticulously arranged to capture the exact proportions of the imperial symbol. The renders who maintained these structures had elevated their work to an art form. They no longer simply processed remains for utility. They selected specific bones for aesthetic qualities, sorting them by size, density, and coloration to create patterns within the larger structures. The most skilled renders were assigned to the chapel, where they crafted devotional iconography from the smallest bones, phalanges and carpals arranged in mosaics depicting imperial saints and heroes. What had begun as necessity had evolved into devotion. The ossification doctrine now had its priesthood, its rituals, and its sacred texts, the latter being Dravik's leather-bound notebooks, filled with his precise calculations and architectural schematics. The renders spoke of eternal service and physical transcendence, concepts that transformed the horror of our methods into a twisted form of veneration. I had attempted to alert imperial authorities to the disturbing evolution of our compound. My first report, submitted through official channels to the Adeptus Munitorum, detailed our defensive innovations with clinical precision. I emphasized the efficiency of our methods while noting the psychological impact on our personnel. The response arrived 3 weeks later, a commendation for resource efficiency in adverse conditions and a request for more detailed construction schematics. My second report went to an administratum overseer who visited our compound as part of a planetary reconstruction assessment. I guided him through our facilities, watching his face for signs of the revulsion I had once felt. Instead, his expression remained impassive as he made notations in his data slate. When we reached the processing chapel, where renders were preparing newly acquired remains, he asked detailed questions about our throughput capacity and material yield rates. His final assessment praised our innovative utilization of otherwise wasted biological resources and recommended study of our techniques for potential implementation at other imperial installations. Most disturbing was the reaction of an ecclesiarchy priest who arrived to reconsecrate the chapel. Father Morden was an elderly man with augmetic eyes that whirred softly as they focused on our bone constructions. I had expected condemnation, perhaps even threats of declaring us heretics. Instead, he spent hours examining the devotional iconography crafted from human remains. He ran withered fingers across mosaics of finger bones arranged in the shape of imperial saints. He stood silently before the bone aquila, his lips moving in what appeared to be prayers of admiration rather than exorcism. When he finally addressed the assembled garrison, Morden declared our work a testament to mankind's devotion to the Golden Throne. Our use of human remains represented the ultimate expression of sacrifice, service that continued beyond death, beyond the separation of soul from body. In the priest's interpretation, we had created a physical manifestation of the emperor's eternal vigilance, a monument to humanity's unyielding duty. His theological justification spread through the garrison like a contagion. What had been done out of desperate necessity was now imbued with spiritual purpose. The renders began incorporating explicit religious symbolism into their constructions. Skull walls were arranged in patterns that echoed passages from the Lectitio Divinitatis. Bone supports were carved with prayers and devotional texts. The processing of remains became accompanied by hymns and litanies, transforming butchery into sacrament. I found myself unable to object. My data demonstrated the effectiveness of our methods. My reports received commendation rather than censure. Every imperial authority who witnessed our creation found justification for it within their own organizational framework. The administratum saw efficiency. The militarum saw defensive innovation. The ecclesiarchy saw devotion. None saw the horror that had become invisible to us all. The expansion continued, driven now by zealotry rather than necessity. Dravik's calculations took on new dimensions as he incorporated aesthetic and devotional factors into his designs. Structural elements were arranged not merely for maximum strength, but to create specific visual patterns when viewed from different angles. The entire compound was becoming a massive three-dimensional devotional text, legible only to those who understood the language of bone and sinew we had created. With the immediate threat eliminated and imperial supply lines re-established, we faced a new challenge, the acquisition of materials. Our processing techniques had been refined to extract maximum utility from each corpse, but our construction pace now exceeded our legitimate supply of remains. The dead from the Orc conflict had been fully utilized. Disease and natural attrition provided insufficient resources for our expanding ambitions. I first noticed the discrepancies in my supply ledgers 3 weeks after the Ecclesiarchy's blessing of our work. The number of processed remains exceeded the documented casualties and natural deaths within our compound. When I brought this to Dravik's attention, he dismissed my concerns with uncharacteristic vagueness, mentioning alternative procurement channels established through the Adeptus Munitorum. My investigation revealed the truth behind these channels. Our renders had begun recruiting from the refugee camps that had sprung up across the devastated planet. Dravik's teams would visit these camps, ostensibly to identify skilled laborers for reconstruction efforts. Their actual selection criteria had nothing to do with skills and everything to do with physical characteristics, bone density, skeletal proportion, cranial formation. Individuals with optimal skeletal structure would be transported to our compound, officially registered as reconstruction workers, then disappear from the administrative records. I discovered the processing chambers during a routine inspection of our expanded facilities. The lower levels of the original data vault had been converted into a series of small cells, each containing a single occupant. These individuals, men and women selected for their skeletal qualities, were kept in a drugged state, administered nutrients and supplements to enhance bone density. Medical monitoring equipment tracked their physical condition, ensuring optimal development of the materials that would eventually be harvested. Most horrifying was the methodical nature of this harvesting. Rather than simply killing these captives and processing their remains, Dravik's medical team had developed techniques for gradual extraction. Non-essential bones could be removed while keeping the subject alive, allowing for continued growth and regeneration of remaining tissues. A single captive could provide materials for months before their utility was exhausted. The processing logs documented everything with administrative precision. Subject identification numbers, extraction schedules, yield assessments, material quality ratings. The clinical language disguised the atrocity beneath a veneer of imperial bureaucracy. These weren't people being tortured and gradually dismantled. They were resource nodes being optimally harvested. I should have been horrified. I should have reported this abomination to the Inquisition immediately. Instead, I found myself analyzing the efficiency of the system, noting how the gradual harvesting method increased our material yield by approximately 34% compared to single-event processing. My data slate filled with calculations and projections based on the expanded procurement methods. The Emperor's calculus had become a madman's arithmetic, yet I continued to balance the equations. That night, standing alone on the vertebral spire, I finally confronted the truth of my complicity. I had not merely observed the transformation of our compound, I had facilitated it. My efficiency analyses had justified each expansion of our methods. My reports had deflected potential imperial intervention. My ledgers had disguised the true nature of our procurement behind layers of administrative terminology. The compound sprawled below me, its bone structures gleaming pale in the moonlight. From this height, patterns became visible that couldn't be seen at ground level. The entire complex had been designed according to geometric principles that echoed ancient Terran religious architecture. The layout of buildings, the arrangement of defensive positions, the placement of devotional elements, all formed a cohesive whole that could only be appreciated from above. We had created a massive devotional symbol, a prayer written in human remains across the blasted landscape. In that moment of clarity, I understood that I faced a final choice. I could embrace the ossification doctrine that had consumed us all, accepting my role in the continuation of this horror. I could lose myself in the elegant mathematics of Dravik's calculus, finding comfort in efficiency metrics and construction schematics while ignoring the atrocity they represented. The path would be easy. I had already walked far along it, each step justified by necessity or duty or the Emperor's service. Or I could attempt escape, a desperate flight to reach someone who might recognize the abomination we had created, not the administratum who saw only resource efficiency, not the militarum who saw only defensive innovation, not the ecclesiarchy who saw only twisted devotion. I would need to reach the Inquisition, the only imperial authority with both the perspective to recognize our fall and the power to end it. Either choice would likely end in my death. If I remained, I would eventually be processed myself, either when injury or illness reduced my utility as a living servant, or when Dravik's calculations determined that my skeletal structure would provide optimal materials for some future construction. If I attempted escape, I would be hunted by those who now saw our work as sacred, the Renders and their Catachon allies who believed they served the Emperor through our ossuary architecture. As I descended from the spire, my decision crystallized. I would gather what evidence I could, copies of my ledgers, samples of Dravik's notebooks, picked captures of the processing chambers. I would attempt to reach the Imperial Command Post established at the planetary capital, now rebuilding after the Orc devastation. If I could speak directly to an inquisitorial representative, perhaps our abomination could be ended before it spread further. I knew the odds of success were minimal. Even if I escaped the compound, the journey across the war-ravaged landscape would be perilous. Even if I reached the capital, penetrating the layers of imperial bureaucracy to reach someone with both authority and moral clarity would be nearly impossible. Even if I found such a person, convincing them to act against a project that had received blessings from multiple imperial organizations would require evidence more compelling than my horrified testimony. Yet I had to try. The alternative was unthinkable, not because of what would happen to me, but because of what would happen to others. Our methods would spread, our doctrine would find adherence beyond our compound. Our architecture of devotion would rise on other worlds, justified by the same cold calculus that had led us to this point. As I made my final preparations, collecting data slates and securing them in a waterproof pouch, I reflected on the journey that had brought me here. 3 months ago, I had been a simple data curator, concerned with agricultural production records and tithe calculations. Now I was preparing to flee from a fortress of human remains, carrying evidence of atrocities committed in the Emperor's name. The irony was not lost on me. My entire life had been dedicated to the organization and preservation of information. Now information was the only weapon I had against the horror we had created. If I failed, the data vault would continue its transformation, expanding across the landscape like a cancer of bone and sinew. If I succeeded, everything we had built would be purged, likely along with everyone who had participated in its creation, myself included. In the grim darkness of the 41st millennium, there is only war, not just the obvious conflict of armies and fleets, but the subtle warfare of ideologies and beliefs. The ossification doctrine represented a new front in that eternal conflict, a corruption of imperial values that transformed service into atrocity. I had helped create it. Now I would try to destroy it, knowing that either outcome would likely end with my death. As I slipped from my quarters in the pre-dawn darkness, I carried with me the knowledge that in the Imperium of Man, death may indeed be the only mercy left. For those trapped in our processing chambers, for those who would be recruited in the future, for those of us who had become monsters in the name of duty, death would be a release from the architecture of devotion we had created. The Emperor's calculus had failed us. Or perhaps we had failed it, twisting mathematics into madness, efficiency into evil. Either way, the equation had to be balanced, and in the accounting of the Imperium, such balance is usually achieved in blood.